there in the early 60s with rather tragic results. But it was all concrete, and over the years it just started to deteriorate. But it was always fun to get down there on Thanksgiving to watch Classical and Lynn English duke it out. But of course, there were more duking outs underneath the stands than there were on the ball field itself.
Oh, that's not cool.
It was the truth. I'll tell you, it was crazy underneath. Yeah. But it was, you had to go to the games. It was Eastland versus Westland, and there's not so much of the Eastland-Westland spirit anymore. But those of us of a certain age remember Eastland-Westland, and if we can get Steve on the horn, you know, he'll attest to it. It was Lynn Classical and Lynn English, and there was a definite dividing line between two sections of the city.
All right, tell you what we're going to do. We had a little bit of a glitch there where some of the stuff didn't get on, but we're back on live. I'm going to play the interview that Bill Newell did with Revere High School football coach Lou Ciccatelli and see if we can get a hold of Steve after that, and then we'll check in with Salem High School football coach Matt Bouchard, as they are the Gannis Classic, the Gannis Football Classic coaches this year. So we'll do that, and Tim, stand by, hang in there, and let me get this interview on with Coach Ciccatelli in just a second here.
Revere High School football coach Lou Ciccatelli is joining us, coach of the Agganis South All-Star team that will be playing Wednesday night at Manning Field in Lynn. Lou, welcome. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Bill, for having me. Always a pleasure.
Well, the South team, give me an update on where the South players are coming from. What communities, towns, and so on?
Yeah, so obviously, Revere, Winthrop, we have Chelsea, Bishop Fenwick, Everett, St. John's Prep, Essex Tech, Northeast Metro Tech, and Peabody.
Nice, all right.
Yep.
So when you got word that you were coaching the Agganis game, what are you thinking? I mean, obviously, I think that's a great honor.
Oh, it's a very, very great honor. It's always great when you get recognized and someone obviously chooses to do one of these all-star games, and it's always good stuff. And, yeah, I mean, I've done a few of these games before, and, Paul Halloran and Matt Durgan do a great, great job with all the scholarships and the fundraisers in this program. And so just to be a part of it, I feel very blessed and lucky, and I'm always happy to do it.
So tell me about the approach to coaching an all-star game. You don't have the players for that long. Maybe tell us about that. And of course, with the game coming right up on Wednesday. So, I mean, but it is what it is, and that's fine. But just tell, what is the approach, and what do you try to accomplish in the days of practice that you do, limited days that you do have?
Yeah, it's a short week. I mean, you're looking at maybe 8-9 days before the game on Wednesday. And the biggest thing is, trying to get everybody there at the same time. And it's tough. You know, some kids work, so they have different schedules. But we've been fortunate. We've got around 32 kids on the roster, and I've had about 27, 28 every night. Those numbers, you can work with those. In the big part with the All-Star games, it's always easier to just do an offense and a defense. And if you can do that, you can get a lot more practice time in. You can do a lot more things, in that short period of time. And, we're making it work. The kids have a great attitude. They're showing up on time. We're getting them out of there on time. And, we're just trying to make it a fun environment, but a serious environment, because I tell them too, the biggest thing I get concerned about in these games is injuries because of the layoff and because some kids are somewhat out of shape, but, I should say not in football shape. So that's a little worrisome. So we did a lot of tackling drills, a lot of form stuff, a lot of tackling drills. And, we did a regular practices like I always would at Revere. And I think we're going to be okay. I'm happy for what I see, and I think they'll be ready.
Well, maybe you could drop a few names of several of the players that you've had, and maybe some of the, when you coach an all-star game, all of a sudden you're working with these players that you've heard about on the North Shore. Some of these teams, obviously, you don't play against, like the Prep and so on, or Fenwick, but obviously you're aware of a lot of the names from around the North Shore and the athletes, but as a coach you would be. So drop a name or two of some of the guys that that you're expecting to do a lot for you guys on Wednesday night.
Yeah, so there's so many of them. And, some of the Peabody kids stick out. Obviously, we've got Shea Lynch from Peabody. He's one of our quarterbacks. And we also have Danny Barrett, wide receiver, from Peabody. And the Peabody kids have been doing great. Maximus Rizza from St. John's Prep. Jay Dooley from Peabody. Where is he? I want to make sure I get, because these guys have been great. Welvis Acosta from Winthrop. My guy, Jason Shosho from Revere. And Kamari Ellaby, the quarterback from Everett. So these guys have been here every day, working hard. Costa Beechin from Bishop Fenwick. So some good names, some kids that shined, obviously, during the season. And it's just been a pleasure. We've had a blast. It's been one thing about these All-Star games, they're fun. You get to make, you know, new relationships with kids you didn't have a chance to, but they can be a lot of fun. So.
Yeah, no, obviously you've dropped some great names, and, you know, just hearing those names, it just kind of, you flash back to the fall of 2022 for sure with all those names, Costa Beecham and, of course, Shea Lynch and Danny Barrett from Peabody High. What a year those guys had. Unbelievable season, numbers-wise, stat-wise for those two guys for sure. Well, who's coaching with you, Lou? Who's helping you out coaching for the game? I'm sure it's not the guy barking behind you, but who else? Who's helping?
My dog. I'm sorry. Never stop. Yeah, so my staff is obviously my staff, Oscar Lopez, Jared Godinez. I'm sorry, Phil.
No, that's no problem. It's not a problem at all. Just go the best that you can, Lou. Just do the best you can.
Yeah, sure. Never ends.
Maybe you could start over. I'm sorry. Yeah, okay.
Brandon Brito, those are my three guys coming with me. And I've got Northeast Vocational Tech with us. Of course, head coach Don Hears. Mike DeFelice is with us. And so those are the guys kind of coaching on that side of the ball. So that's what we got for staff.
Yeah. Lou, anything else you want to share with us about the Aganis game and, you know, leading up to Wednesday's kickoff?
No, I'm just, like I said, happy to do it. You know, I always tell the coaches and my kids too, it's a great way to kick into a football season too, you know, because you get that bug again. It's hard to sleep at night and you're thinking about things and schemes and all that stuff. And here it is, it's only June. But it's a great feeling. I'm proud to be a part of it. And like I said, the best part is meeting new guys and making new relationships, so.
Well, on that note, Lou, we'll let you go. Hang on the line for a second here. But, Lou, thanks for your time, and best of luck to you, your coaching staff, and, of course, those great players that you have with you on Wednesday night, and have a great game.
Thanks, Bill. Appreciate it, as always.
Yeah, take care. Hold on. That's Lou Ciccatelli, Revere head coach, coach of the South for the Aganis All-Star football game Wednesday night at Manning Field in Lynn at 6.
All right, thank you to Bill Newell and to Revere coach Lou Ciccatelli. Great to hear Coach Ciccatelli be involved in the Aganis Classics and to be so excited about it. We miss him from the Northeastern Conference, but just a great part and friend of MSO News Sports. And thank you, Coach Ciccatelli. Looking forward to talking to you down the line as well. Joining us now, Steve Krause, who is my goodness, we've known Steve. Steve and I have, and Tim, for a long time, covered the same stuff, have sort of the same philosophy with respect to student athletes. Steve is also a tremendous philosopher, if I could put it that way. He waxes poetic and beautifully online with sports and news commentary, and I love it, and I hope maybe we can get him on here on our show or at least on our website. But Steve, you're also, first of all, welcome, Steve. Thanks for joining us tonight. And you have been an integral part of the Aganis Classic Week for so long, and we hope to pick your brain a little bit about that tonight.
Beautiful. Yeah, it's a cause I believe in, you know, passionately.
We were talking. So, go ahead, Tim.
Rick and I were talking about football games being played at the old Manning Bowl, and how significant it was, and you know, it was one of the best football fields around for decades, and the fact it was built during the Depression, but it just the size of it, and for the kids to go and play there on a weekly basis had to be a thrill for those kids.
I remember from when I was a kid going to those games, and I remember from my 4 years of high school, we'd all go down to Manning Bowl to see the kids from the prep that got picked for the game. There was always at least one or two. I just, from the earliest part of my life, fell in love with that place. You know, it just seemed to be so, you know, for a kid that was like 9 or 10 and didn't have any other point of reference, it just seemed so majestic. I mean, those big gates that they had in the old bowl that you went into and everything. I mean, it just seemed like, wow, we got a big league stadium right in our backyards. And, you know, it was, as I got older, of course, it became less and less majestic just because I had bigger points of reference and everything. But it never lost its majesty for me, that old bowl. You know, I go there and sit in those cement seats and, you know, it just seemed, you know, important. No matter what was going on in there, it was important. And I'm not saying that the new stadium is any less that way, but, you know, it's beautiful, but it looks like a high school football field. Whereas the one before, you know, it looked like a real stadium. And, you know, I never played a football game on the field there because they didn't go to Lynch schools. But I certainly went to enough. I can imagine for a kid having grown up with that field, to get on that field and play on it must have just been a tremendous, tremendous thrill. And the Aganis game to me was the epitome of the whole year. You'd watch it during the fall, and then you'd go to the games, and it just seemed like the final capstone, if you, as it were, of the year, and it was just such a big deal back in those days.
Yeah, Steve, even they used to have the World Championship for the Drum and Bugle Corps, and the Crusaders.
So I never went to them.
Oh, that was wild.
I'm sure it was.
The music they produced, and it was like, oh, these guys are amazing. You know, I actually went to high school at Dobbs Abbey with the kid who was a member of the Crusaders. And it was just an amazing thing year after year to go up there, and they always hosted one of their big competitions. And again, it was just that kind of, it was almost like you said, a college venue.
Where
you could go and watch high school sports.
Yeah, it sort of seemed like a little bit of outside the box when you compare it to going to Bloxwich Field to see the Big Blue, you know, or any place like Stackpole Field to see Saugus. And even our stadium at St. John's, you know, they all look the same. I mean, they all had two sides, a little press box and everything. And then you go to Manning Bowl, and it looked like Ann Arbor, for heaven's sakes.
Yeah.
You know? And it was just, I just miss it.
Steve,
everything about it.
Let me ask you about your involvement with the Aganis Classic. We've talked and we've had you on many times talking about the majesty and the history of the Aganis aura and who he was. And I know that the coaches involved probably in all the sports tell their kids, all stars from all over the North Shore, about the Aganis legacy. But in terms of what you've done, Steve, in working with the Aganis Foundation over the years, as a news person, as a journalist, as a sports fan, what's the one thing that, or more than one thing, what comes to mind when you hear the words Aganis Foundation? I mean, if you look back on all the stuff that's gone on since you and I and Tim and Bill have all known one another, when you say the Aganis Foundation and the scholarships and that, what jumps out at you? What do you hold dear about this this legacy, this tradition?
Well, I think for me, one thing I remember is interviewing various kids and finding out that, for the most part, I can't say that in every case, but for the most part, before those kids that aren't playing in the game ever set foot on a practice field, coach gets them together and talks a little bit about Harry Aganis and why they're playing this game and why it's such a big deal. You know, he's just not some name they drew out of a hat. You know, there's a real important link to Lynn's history when you're playing in this game. And, you know, Tim and I were both 2 years old when he died, you know, and, so we didn't really know from anything about it. But growing up, one thing I remember more than anything else is that his nephew played Little League Baseball with me. His nephew was a kid named Harry Ramo. And Harry Ramo was on the Little League team for 2 years. And he used to go around saying, Harry Aganis was my uncle. And I didn't know who he was talking about. Who in the world is Harry Aganis? And why should I care that he was your uncle? And then I grew up maybe two streets over from a guy by the name of Peter Trovich, who was a fairly significant athlete back in the 60s at Lynn Classical. And so I asked him once, who is this Harry Aganis he keeps talking about? And, of course, Peter talked to me for about the next 10 years about Harry and his legacy and how good he was and everything.
Mm-hmm.
And then I found out he played around the same time my cousin was growing up. And my cousin filled me in, you know, men playing with boys and things like that. So that by the time I got old enough to contribute to it, I pretty much knew everything there was to know about him. And what you find out as you get older is that the name is not just limited to Lynn. I was on a train coming back from New York once, and it was an Amtrak train. And I went to the club car to get a drink. And this guy, I had a Harry Aganis tournament T-shirt on. And this guy comes up to me, looks at my shirt, and goes, Harry Aganis, I remember him from when he was on the Red Sox. Turns out the guy was from Michigan, and he knew who Harry Aganis was. So one of the things you find out is that his name has a lot more cachet than just around here. And the other thing you find out is that what Joe DiMaggio was to the Italians from the 1930s and 40s, that's what Harry Aganis was to the Greeks. You know, and they just hold his name in such reverence that you realize, wow, I mean, this guy was a big deal. You know, you read about his funeral and how just the streets of Lynn were just clogged, you know, choked with people, you know, all the way from St. George's up to Pine Grove. This guy was loved. You know, it didn't hurt that he was a sort of Jack Armstrong, all-American boy type of guy. You know, but he was loved. He was revered. Not just by Greeks either, by anybody who knew him. He was revered. He was just somebody everybody wanted to be. And the fact that he was taken, it'll be 68 years tomorrow, as a matter of fact, June 27th, 1955. And the fact that he was taken at the age of 26 is just a sin. I mean, you know, there's a guy... The sky was the limit with how good he was going to be, and it was all gone by the age of 26, and it was a horrible tragedy.
Yeah, it certainly was. And you know, it wasn't like he was from West Lynn, and I was telling Rick before we came on, you know, he grew up on Water Hill Street where I first lived as a very young kid, and but he really was owned by the city. You know, because of what he accomplished, especially after he left Glasgow and he went to beat the Stars there. I think anybody from Lynn, no matter where you were from, you know, yeah, well, Harry, you know, you owned Harry. And you may never have seen him play, but of course you told everybody that you had. You know?
Yeah, well, that would have been a lie for me, I'll tell you.
Well, yeah, it would have been a lie. It would have been a lie for both of us, but it's like one of those things where, you know, if you were of the proper age, then you know, oh yeah, I saw him play a lot of time at Meeting Bowl, you know, and you never got near it.
I know my father told me he saw Harry play, you know. Yeah. He probably did, though. Dad, he was a Saugus High guy.
Yeah, but it had been just amazing to watch Harry play as a high school, especially his junior and senior year when he was really establishing himself and thinking, wow, this guy is just so much better than everybody else in the field, you know.
Well, he was so much better than everybody else when he played for BU, too. I mean, he was just a cut above everybody. He met his match when he played against, I think it was Maryland in that I forget what the name of that game was he played in, but he got handled pretty well by Maryland. You know, that was his level. But if that was his level, it was a major league level. I mean, there was no denying that, you know, he was going to go all the way. But, you know, one other thing about him is he did not take the path of least resistance because he had all kinds of chances in football, which was his better sport, and he chose baseball. So he was, he understood struggle, and he understood, you know, being competitive. And I just can't find anything bad to say about him.
Steve, let me ask you about the Aganis week, how it has grown, because when Bill and I first started at WESX back in the last century, a long time ago, the Aganis football game was pretty much it. It was so important, and it was a kickoff for us to get ready for the football season, you know, the high school football season. But now, over the years, it has grown. So many kids get invested in it, get involved in it, get to play one more high school game because so many of them are not going to play in college, and some of them are awarded with scholarships. So maybe speak to the legacy of that and your opinion of all of that.
Well, when they started expanding the course, they started with the baseball game. And I thought that was great because, gee whiz, you know, I know that he was a great football player and all that, but he was a professional baseball player. So, sure, baseball makes a lot of sense. Then they filled in with softball, two soccer games, two basketball games, and two lacrosse games. You go back you think about it a second, and Harry, of course, came from St. George's, and I think basketball was the other religion at St. George's Church, you know? I don't think you went to St. George's without playing some basketball. Timmy, you back me up on this, you know. People from European extraction who came over here, they came over here with soccer. I never understood why soccer wasn't bigger in the U.S. since, you know, we are largely Spanish and European descent, but all the sports kind of dovetail with what he might have been playing when he was a kid, except for maybe lacrosse. I don't know. Somebody will have to fill me in on that, but it was... regardless of what it was, it's just a chance for high school seniors all over the area to have one more bite at the apple in his name. And I think it was a great thing the foundation did giving him that chance because, you might have missed out in the state finals or you might have lost in the first round. And then all of a sudden, whoops, you got one more game to look forward to. It's a great thing, and these kids love it.
Mm-hmm.
They love it.
You waiting on me, Rick?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. I had the opportunity. I think it was 2003 or 2004 to coach in the baseball game, and it truly was an honor to be in charge of a team full of all stars, and both sides which were just loaded with talent, and I still have my game jersey hanging up in my closet, and it's just something that you always keep with you. And what an honor it was for the coaches in the league to ask me to participate at that level. And certainly, I look tackle with a great deal of pride.
Yeah, I would have loved to have been able to do that, but I was never a coach anywhere. But, you know, I having covered it for so long and having worked on the program for as long as I did and have done other things, you know, my wife is, for years went down there on the night of the football game and helped out with the concessions. And so it became a family affair for us. I don't think there was ever a year or that I didn't really want to do it. It was just, there were times when it just, it was a lot of work and everything. But, you know, you knew why you were doing it. And as long as you knew why you were doing it and you were good with that, it didn't seem like, it didn't seem as bad as you would think because of the way the thing is set up, you have to do everything almost at the last minute. And as you know, anything that you do at the last minute is a crapshoot because, you just don't have the time you'd like to take to make sure it gets done right. But, you know, with everybody we had Paul Halloran helping out, had Grant, me, a few others, you know, it got done and it got done right. So, and, you know, for the guy, his legacy and everything, we owed it to him to get it done right, never mind anybody else. So, like I said, it was always a privilege working for it and covering it and sitting next to Matt Roy up in the press box helping him through the scoreboard.
Yep.
You know, it was just, it was the same cast of characters year after year after year, and the only thing, what united everybody and what was good about everybody was that everybody was there for the right reason. Nobody was there for personal glory. Nobody was there so they could get their name in the paper or anything like that. Everybody was there because we understood and we believed in the foundation and the legacy. And, you know, you don't find too many cases where you have that. But when you do, boy, you can do anything.
Well spoken, Steve. Listen, we got Mike Grenier warming up in the bullpen here. If you want to come back next week, I have an assignment for you, if you're interested. I'd be interested to know what your Power Five is for local television sports broadcasters. We're putting together a list of, you know, a list of top whatever, for the summer.
All
because
time or, just this era?
I would say all time. Who's your favorite? They don't even, yeah, because I've got my list. I'm going to ask Tim for his. I'm going to ask Mike for his. I'd like the local, your top five local broadcasters sports.
I could tell you my number one right now. I just have to go 2 and 5. So.
Yeah. Hold on to it, man. Hold on to it because I want to know.
All right.
If you're willing, let's come back next week.
I'm willing.
Awesome. Thanks, Steve.
All right. Take care.
Take care, Steve.
Okay, Rick. Bye.
All right. That's Steve Krause, who is the, he was the Item sports editor for many years. He was an Item news editor. He still writes for the Item and just a fabulous guy and knows a whole lot about a lot of stuff. We'll take a break and come back with Mike Grenier. He is our basketball insider, but a lot going on in sports that he is going to get to. And Tim, that's if you want to do that, that's part of your assignment too. Next week I want your top five TV broadcasters in sports in the Boston area, local, your local top five TV sportscasters.
God, we've had so many good ones.
Yep.
And in fact, even I was watching TV the other night, and they had a Patriots highlight on, and of course, the golden pipes of Gil Santos.
Gil Santos, yep.
And as soon as I heard it, I thought, I miss his voice.
As do I. I used to listen to him at 5:45 when I was teaching in the morning. That he used to wake up to the BZ Sports.
Yep.
All right, we'll be back. That's Tim Kearns. I'm Rick Moore, producer and engineer Bill Proposky. Mike Grenier will be next.
Hi, folks. This is Gerard Moynihan of Moynihan Lumber. And if you're planning to replace the windows in your home, I have just two words for you. Anderson Windows. Anderson is the most trusted name in windows throughout the United States. See the complete line of Anderson windows on display at Moynihan Lumber in Beverly, North Reading, and Plaistow, New Hampshire, or visit us at MoynihanLumber.com.
Moynihan Lumber, we measure up.
All right, we are back. Mike Grenier is here, another sports journalist whom we love to talk with and has so much knowledge. I gave him an assignment last week, but we're going to probably have to put that off for a while because there's so much to talk about right now, and the Celtics are the story that just keeps on giving. Mike, how are you doing?
Good, good. You're right. Here it is, June 26th, and there's as much Celtics news right now as if they were in the NBA conference finals or something against Miami, you know?
Well, I'm going to let you get into it and see what you and Tim have to say, and I'll be on the sidelines. Bring me in when you feel like it.
Okay, well, sure. I mean, Tim, I guess we have, right off the top, we have to talk about the newest Celtics, Kristaps Porzingis, out of Latvia, 27 years old. You know, he's the big guy that they got for Marcus Smart, and I think it took a lot of people by surprise that at the last minute, the trade kind of fell apart. They were going to get Malcolm Brogdon. They were going to give him away for Porzingis, but it ended up being Marcus Smart, who now winds up in Memphis. And you lose a guy who's been the, sort of the heart and soul, at least, you know, in terms of team spirit and team chemistry and all that. You're rid of Marcus Smart, but you're gaining a 7'3" guy in Porzingis, who averaged 23 points a game last year, who averaged nearly 9 rebounds per game, and who actually, even though the knock on him, Tim, is that he's missed quite a few games in his career. I can tell you exactly, 237. He's only 27 years old. However, he did play in 65 games last season, which, by the way, was more than Marcus Smart played. And he's at the peak of his career in terms of being a productive player, and he's only 27 years old. So he's 7'3", and I think that's a big key for the Celtics right there. They needed another big man, because Al Horford's 37 years old, and Robert Williams tends to be injured a lot.
Yeah, and the one thing that Porzingis gives you is he's 7'3", but as much as I hate to say it, he can play outside. He can shoot the three. He can get to the foul line. You know he's gonna make those. And I just hope that, you know, the inside game becomes a sizable chunk of his offensive repertoire and leaves the three as a late alternative, as a trailer maybe. That's where they really need the help. Williams is so tough down below, you know, getting rebounds, but like I said, he gets injured a lot, and so you need a big body down there. And with Al getting older and he's not going to play any more minutes, and Williams getting hurt and him playing less games, you're going to have to rely upon literally the big guy to get you rebounds and get you points.
Yeah, and to my first thought, as soon as they acquired Porzingis, who was kind of brittle, in other words, he's not like he's not built like Embiid or let's say Jokic. He's more slightly built than that, but he is in good shape. And my first thought was that at 7'3", he shoots over people. Okay, whether he's taking a three pointer. By the way, he hit almost 40% of his three pointers last season, and he shot 50% overall, like 49%. Okay, overall. But my first thought, Tim, was with all the zone that Miami Heat played against the Celtics in the playoffs, and it gave him considerable trouble, Porzingis is the ideal player against the zone in the sense that, like you said, going inside a little bit, when you pass the ball outside and you post the guy at the foul line against the zone, Porzingis could shoot over anybody from that angle, right? To me, that was the biggest critical element in, at least one of the critical elements in bringing him here.
Yeah, you know, and I'm just looking through ESPN, and we just had the kiss of death. Stephen A. has Celtics as title favorite after Porzingis' trip.
Oh no!
that's a little bit of a, you know, it's kind of a little bit premature to say that. And I also heard Tim somebody say the Celtics have a new big three, meaning, you know, Jaylen Brown, of course, and Jason Tatum, and now Porzingis. I just dismissed that out of hand. The last big three they had won a championship, and that was Garnett, Ray Allen, you know, that group there. And, of course, the great big three of McHale, Parrish, and Bird. So You can't put these guys in that class yet. They have to win a couple of titles first.
Well, I want to interrupt, if I could, guys. I want to ask you a couple of quick questions,
sure.
Mike. First of all, with the guard situation, trading Marcus Smart, whom I absolutely love,
yep.
Is it addition by subtraction? Meaning that frees up Brogdon, whom I also love, and Derek White to be the point. And then, secondly, I think that... I forgot the second point. Never mind. Let's just stick with that. Addition by subtraction?
Yeah, well, in a sense, I mean, obviously the Celtics' original idea was to have Brogdon be part of the trade package. It fell apart at the last minute because the Clippers, who were originally part of the deal, were afraid of his injury status. They got down to the midnight deadline, and they wanted a healthy player to became a three-team trade and all that stuff. So Brogdon, the only thing wrong with him, people were knocking him after the playoffs because he got hurt. And he was ineffective the last two or three games of the playoffs. However, he had a phenomenal season, sixth man of the year. He shot almost 44% on three-pointers throughout the season, one of the best three-point shooters in the entire league. And that's a good point, Rick. The point guard situation changes with Marcus Smart gone. Now, is Brogdon a true point guard? Not really, but he can handle that position. He's experienced. He's smart. He can shoot it. He can pass. Derek White can play that position. I think it's almost a point guard by default right now. Either one of them can do the job. They're not true point guards, but they can get by with those guys because of the talent that surrounds them. Will Brad Stevens go for and we also have to remember Peyton Pritchard will be part of this rotation next year. Unless they trade him soon or get rid of him for some reason, I don't see now why they need to get rid of Peyton Pritchard. He has a lot of ability to get into the basket and dishing off. So I think he becomes actually a more valuable piece of the puzzle in the sense that he can penetrate and he can dish the ball off to the outside shooters. So I think that the point guard situation is a state of flux, but I can see any of those three guys doing the job over a 48-minute period. You can have, Pritchard doing it for 15 minutes. You can have Brogdon doing it for 28 minutes. Or you can have Derek White playing that position as well. So I think it's an okay, even if it's by default, any of those three guys can handle, or the combination of the three guys can handle that very important position. Tim, what do you think?
Yeah, I think so, too. I think they all demonstrated during the season, Mike, that they're all capable of doing it. Can they do it for extended periods now with Smart gone? But we saw what they did while he was out over extended periods as well during the course of the season. And White certainly has to be, confidence has to be buoyed by the way that he was able to play and dictate the flow of the game and control the floor, bring it down. You know, hell bent for leather on the fast break, pull up nicely, get the inside pass working. I thought he did a great job. I thought he probably should have been playing even more than he was doing so because he had so much energy out on the court. So, and Marcus was always one of those that, he was the lead guy. But at the same time, see, we do things that would drive me crazy.
Oh yeah, of course. And he's not really a true point guard. I mean, he's sort of a combo guard. And his play did go downhill a little bit last season compared to the previous year when he won the Defensive Player of the Year for the entire league. He admitted himself that he didn't play well defensively, and of course, the big knock on him was he'd take wide open threes in critical situations and miss them. Well, Tatum did the same thing, and so did Jaylen Brown. But I think the fact that we have to point out, Rick and Tim, is now you got a new team, a new look with Porzingis, who definitely is an upgrade, obviously. It makes the Celtics, I think, on balance, a better team than they were a year ago when you have Porzingis, only 27 years old, and averages nearly 23.5 points a game last season. I think it's an upgrade in talent. And the big question mark is, will Joe Mazzulla recognize this and be able to put the pieces in the right places? Because that was the big to-do in the playoffs, especially. His coaching was exposed to a certain degree. He didn't know how to handle Miami's zone.
Well, Mike, talk about that. Talk about the new assistant coaches who have come in.
Sure.
Exact point.
I mean, they've got, you know, Sam Cassell, who was with the Celtics back in the, you know, around the time that Garnett played. And you have a couple other assistants who have NBA experience, more NBA experience. And will Mazzulla take those words into account and act upon them? I mean, that still remains to be seen. I would think that Brad Stevens has had a long talk with Mazzulla since the season ended and say, you know, Joe, you're our head coach. You make the final decisions, but you're going to need a lot of input from these assistant coaches, and you're going to listen to them. Sam Cassell has great experience. He's been around the league now as an assistant coach for like 11 or 12 years. And this guy, Lee, who played basketball, I think you mentioned that Bucknell with Kevin Betancourt at Peabody, he's been around the league for 9 or 10 years. So you have some experienced guys who are going to help out Mazzulla, and you just have to hope that Mazzulla is not so stubborn as to ignore those guys, because if he puts the pieces in the right places and he doesn't shorten the benches, to me, one of the biggest things was he shortened the bench too much in the off season, in the playoff season, because Sam Hauser, to me, was an overlooked guy in the postseason in terms of breaking down the zone. He could have broken down that Miami zone with his outside shooting, but he got very little opportunity to play, and I thought that was a big maybe mistake that on Joe Mazzulla's part. He didn't play him, and Pritchard really didn't play a whole lot of minutes as well. So I think Mazzulla has to rethink his entire philosophy in terms of how to approach the game. And Tim, I want to get your take on this. When we watched the Denver Nuggets win the championship, how many times did we see Jokic, who definitely, you know, could have been the MVP last season, how many times do we see Jokic come down with a defensive rebound and then lead the fast break on his own? And which brings me to my point of how many times do we see the Celtics take the ball out of bounds and Jason Tatum is bringing the ball up and it takes him 7 or 8 seconds to get the ball over half court and they settle into a half court offense with 15 seconds left on the 24-second clock. You've got to speed up the game if you're the Celtics. You have great talent with Tatum, with Brown, with Porzingis. You have, you know, guys that can shoot from outside, guys who can take it to the basket. Why not speed up the game? The Denver Nuggets do it. Jokic doesn't look particularly athletic, but he's phenomenal at that kind of game, speeding up the game. So,
well, he's not just right down the middle of the court.
Right.
You know, a couple of bounces, a couple of long strides, and he's already across, you know, half court, and he's looking to pass it off. The problem with Tatum is he wants to put on a dribbling exhibition as he brings it up. He wants to he wants to get somebody to come up on him so he can try to dribble around him. And how many times did we see him actually lose the ball, have it stripped away, easy 2 points? You know, get up the ball. And think about when Larry Bird brought the ball up the court. It was run, dribble, and all of a sudden he's looking down the court.
Oh, yeah.
So who's wide open, and the ball's out of his hands, and it's underneath the basket.
Yep, you know? I mean, that was the difference, the essential difference.
Never mind Larry taking the ball in bounds, because he was taking it, turning around, sprinting, and head up, always head up, looking for the bid to give the ball to, and it was either McHale, or it was Parrish, or it was Max, or it was one of the guys, DJ, or whoever, Danny, and giving them the ball in like almost a half-court pass.
That's right.
To get something going. This is like the Jason Tatum show. Hey, watch me dribble up the court. Watch me take on one guy. Watch me try to take on two. Watch me watch those two guys go the other way. It used to drive me nuts. Get the ball.
Me too.
And you know you
me too.
Practice. Because if there are two guys on you, that means somebody's wide open. Get them the ball.
Yep. And I think, you know, if Mazzulla sits down and watches the way Denver won the championship, it'll occur to him that he needs to change his offensive philosophy, particularly when it comes to spacing out and in terms of speeding up the game, precisely because of what you just said. We both see Tatum. I can't tell you how many times I saw Tatum go over half court with literally less than a second left on the violation for getting over half court. So you cannot start your offense with 15 seconds left in the 24-second clock, because you've already lost the advantage of a mismatch. Like you said, Larry Bird would throw it down to court to McHale or Parrish because he saw the instant mismatch that occurred when you speed up the ball. So this is one thing that Mazzulla has to do he has to change the entire offensive philosophy, or else they're going to be in the same boat that they were in this past season.
All right, Mike.
Belichick has a tremendous talent.
They also gave up Gallinari. We never saw him play.
Right.
And Mosella, whatever his name was, the center.
They lose Gallinari. They lose Mike Muscala.
Muscala. And they get draft picks back. What's the impact of that?
Oh,
do you think there's more stuff to come?
Brad Stevens, since he's been aboard, has never drafted a guy in the first round. So his philosophy is he doesn't believe much in the draft, and that's why even though he had the number 25 pick in the draft last week, he traded it away for the number 31 pick, which became the number 35th pick, which became eventually the number 38 pick. And he really doesn't believe in the draft. And you look at the guy they got, Jordan Walsh. I studied up on him. I saw some film of him out of Arkansas, 6'7". Seems like a nice kid, but he only averaged 7 points per game, and he shot 27% on threes. And let's not forget, right, Tim and Rick, the three-point line in college ball is much closer to the basket than it is in the NBA. So it's even going to be a more difficult shot for Jordan Walsh to make in the NBA. I can't see him. If he makes the team, he'll be at the end of the bench and just not playing, just sporadically, and he'll be spending a lot of time up in Maine with the Maine Celtics playing for them and trying to get a developmental player type of thing. So I don't see him adding much to the roster. So you got to go with the guys you got right now. And with, you know, yes, Gallinari would have been a great outside shooter, but Porzingis is 7 years younger and taller, and he's in the prime of his career. So you're kind of replacing that particular type of player with a much younger, better player who's really coming into his own this past season. And the thing about Porzingis, though, is that if the Celtics don't sign him to a long-term contract, he will be an unrestricted free agent. If we're talking next July 1st here, 2024, if the Celtics don't sign him up for 2 or 3 or 4 years, he will be an unrestricted free agent. So right now, at least at this moment, he's a rental. He's a rental player for one season. The Celtics will try to get, have shown every inclination that they want to sign him for more than a year, more than a couple of years, but obviously that needs to be done. But as of right now, anyway, he's just a one-year rental, and so they'd better win the championship while the window is still open.
Mm-hmm.
Hey, Mike, you know, you're talking about the first draft pick. How many 6'7" guys can you have on a team?
Oh, several.
There should be a limit, because the Celtics seem to go over the limit every year.
Yeah, they have several. Of course, you know, Tatum's a little bit bigger. Jaylen Brown's around that size. But, you know, again, even though we talk about Porzingis and the incoming players and all that stuff, Brogdon being possibly the point guard now, or Derek White, who we all like, but it really comes down to what's Tatum going to adapt himself to? What can he do that's more than what he did a year ago? I think he can do a lot more. I mean, I know it's expecting a lot of him, but he's so athletic. I just don't want to see him become the point forward, you know, which is what he was last season. I think it slows down the team. It makes them, Rick, a far more predictable offensive team. If you're a defensive team like Miami and you've got a good coach, or if you're any of the good teams in the NBA, if you're seeing Jason Tatum take 8 or 9 seconds off the clock, boy, does that help your defense.
What would Tommy...
You have to find a different way.
What would Tommy Heinsohn advise Jason Tatum?
Well, he'd advise him in less than 5 words. Some of them, a couple of them would be cuss words, okay? We cannot repeat them here. Basically, he would tell him to hurry up. And I remember, you know, covering those Celtics team with Tommy Heinsohn as coach, and his, you know, for all the defensive prowess the Celtics had on the Red Owl back with Bill Russell and Casey Jones, that whole group, Heinsohn's philosophy was to run first. Of course he valued defense, and he had Dave Cowens and all that, but their basic philosophy was to run you into the ground, because he had Havlicek, he had JoJo White, he had Don Chaney who could run, Dave Cowens who could run. Those guys, that was a running team in the 1970s, and they won 2 championships. So, you know, I think that's what Tommy Heinsohn would say. God bless his soul. I think that's what he would say to Jason Tatum.
Tim, final words. We're getting late here.
Well, you know, Mike took us back to the 70s so eloquently there. John Havlicek, the man never stopped running. He was the epitome of running.
That's right. You know? Right. Exactly.
And Why don't we bring back the weave? I've always waited for the weave to come back in.
Is it the weave or the wheel?
40 points a game.
Yeah, I know. I actually think Joe Mazzulla is a big key to this coming season, along with Porzingis, of course, and Tatum. I think, really, he has to change the way he does things, and he has to do it radically.
I have another big question for you about the Celtics, but we're going to save that for next week if we all get back together again.
Yeah.
And in the meantime, I was telling Tim, and we had
Steve Krause
on earlier. Yeah, yep. And our assignment, because it's a summer lull, you know, with respect to high school sports, I want you and Tim and Steve to come up with your Power 5 local TV sportscasters. And it's going to be local. It's going to be Boston. It's going to be all time, whenever. I want your top five.
Absolutely. That's a great one. Because we go back, certainly Steve Krause and Tim, we all go back a bit. We remember some of the great sportscasters that we had in the 70s and 80s and all that stuff.
Oh, yeah. Oh, absolutely. And I'll give you a hint as to mine. They're all from Channel 5. So.
Oh, yeah. Channel 5 had a great group.
You gotta take it back to the 60s.
Oh, yeah.
With the Red Sox, you know?
Yep. But they gotta be local TV sportscasters, okay?
Oh, yeah.
That's the homework assignment. Mike, good stuff. We're gonna pick it up because I know there's a lot more to come with the Celtics and there are a lot more questions and thoughts that Tim and I have about the Celtics, and it's great to be talking. We did the same thing last summer. It's still great. It's cool.
That's right. But you know, it's an important summer for the Celtics because, you know, they have something. When you look at it overall, my final thought on this is, other than the Denver Nuggets, the Celtics have a wide open window. I mean, Denver Nuggets are the best team in the NBA.
Mm-hmm.
And after that, it's wide open.
Yeah, and the Celtics are still young, pretty much.
Correct.
All right, Mike, be well. Happy summer. Happy 4th of July, and we'll talk next Monday, I think.
Same to you guys.
All righty, Michael.
Take care, Tim.
Thanks, Mike. Take care.
Yep.
Whew. Tim, I don't know, man. If if I had a studio, we'd go 2 or 3 hours on this, I think.
You know, I want to do my five now, and in fact, I've already written them down. I've already got seven. and all of them belong in the top five.
Okay, I know. Hold on to it, Tim, because this is going to be fun. I think it's going to be a lot of fun as we go through the summer. And I want to do this with a lot of different things, too. You know, have what do they call that? The Mount Rushmore of sports.
Yep.
So I want to do that. And I was thinking about it today, too. And I actually could not, well, I could get down to the top five with TV, but it's hard in the other categories like, radio broadcasters in the area. Radio broadcasters nationally, TV broadcasters nationally. It's really hard to get down to five. So that's going to be the fun of it. And we can compare our answers with one another and either come up with a consensus or not.
Oh, I think there'll be at least three that are consensus.
I know there will be. I know that. At least three. Coach, it's been great, man. It's the summer is here. We'll talk again next week, and thanks for all your contributions, Tim.
No, you're welcome, Rick, anytime.
All right, talk to you later. Take care. All right, that's Tim Kearns, who is our sports analyst, our super sports analyst here at MSNO Sports, and also our ambassador of goodwill. Now, I promised you Matt Bouchard, who is the Salem High School football coach. We got a little messed up on our schedule here this evening. So Bill Newell talked with Matt Bouchard earlier today, along with Coach Lou Ciccatelli of Revere. Coach Bouchard of Salem is coaching the other Aganis team in the Aganis Classic. And so we're going to let Bill talk to Matt Bouchard, and then we'll end it after that. So let's take a break, and we'll be right back with Bill Newell with Salem football coach Matt Bouchard. This is MSO News Sports. This is North Shore Sports Night. Oh, and don't forget, tomorrow, the sports writers will be dropping around 8 a.m. here on MSO News Sports. And this week, the sports writers get the weekend recap, Gloucester St. Peter's Fiesta events with Nick Kukru. The writers discuss possible nail controversy this year on the Greasy Bowl event. Also, the Aganis games on tap, and lots of conversation with Phil Stacey, Matt Williams, Nick Giannano, Nick Kukru, and, of course, hosted by Bill Newell. So that's tomorrow here on MSO News Sports. So check it out.
Hi, folks. This is Gerard Moynihan of Moynihan Lumber. And if you're planning to replace the windows in your home, I have just two words for you. Anderson Windows. Anderson is the most trusted name in windows throughout the United States. See the complete line of Anderson Windows on display at Moynihan Lumber in Beverly, North Reading, and Plaistow, New Hampshire, or visit us at moynihanlumber.com.
Moynihan Lumber, we measure up.
Matt Bouchard is joining us, coach of the North Squad, Gannis All-Star football game, Salem High football coach. And, coach, welcome. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Well, Matt, tell us what you are able to do, or actually, before we get into the practicing, tell me a bit about your reaction and thoughts about being the Gannis head football coach for the North Squad.
Well, it's always an honor. I think the Gannis game is one of the you know, kind of cornerstones of athletics in the Northeast, you know. So getting an opportunity to get out there and coach in June is something always special. I was very excited to do it. I know my staff equally was excited to get out there and work with some of the best talent in the North Shore.
I want to ask you about some of those players in a moment, but tell me about your approach. How does it work, or what can you do, or what do you do, in leading up to an All-Star game?
Yeah, I think, you know, for me, there are a couple components there, right? A lot of these guys haven't had really football-type contact, obviously, for quite some time. So there's a piece there where we need to kind of get them conditioning for contact. But in the same respects, we have limited time to get, you know, a team ready to go play a game. So, you know, we had basically a 6-day game plan, you know, to work through, you know, everything we need to install from offense, defense, and special teams. And the kids were super responsive. You know, obviously we're dealing with talented kids, but I think their football IQ allowed us to really kind of just continue to move through our installs pretty quickly. So we're excited to kind of put some of this together on Wednesday and put on a show for all the fans.
Tell me about some of the players. I know we can't go through all of them, but drop a few names to us and tell me about some of the names and players and roles that they'll have for the North Squad on Wednesday night.
Yeah, no, happy to. I think, you know, I think the North gets, you know, a number of schools that, you know, at Salem I got a chance to compete against. So going into, you know, this game, there was a lot of talent I was very keen to work with. And some talent that I've only seen on film and never, you know, really seen, in person. So, you know, if you're talking about from a skill position, perspective, you know, our rivals over at Beverly, we have, Smalls and Sop, two gentlemen that, are very talented. You know, we have Nick Costa at the linebacker spot from Lynn Classical. You know, I think from a Maskenomet perspective in the running back spot, we have Will Shannon, you know, who we try to defend in the regular season. And it's nice to have him on our side going into this game. So I think if you look, you know, across the board, I think a lot of the talented kids that are in the North Shore, you know, I think, you know, the Gannis Foundation did a great job of, you know, selecting, you know, some of the best kids out there. And we've been really excited over the last 6 days to really work with these guys.
Yeah, so you have a lot of the squad, the way it breaks down, and you never know how they're going to divide it up from year to year. But you have like Northeastern Conference teams or players from the Northeastern Conference teams and also the Lynn schools, I believe, if I'm not mistaken. Does that sound about right? Yeah.
Yeah, so we have Lynn schools, so it'll be Classical, English, Lynn Tech. We have Hamilton Wenham, St. Mary's, Triton, Ipswich, Linfield, Masco, Salem. I think that's in English, obviously.
Yeah. Gotcha. All right. Who's coaching with you this year for the Gannis game?
So we got the Salem staff, you know, working with me. I did bring back Ed Mercia. If you remember, many years ago, Ed Mercia coached with Coach Conley at Salem as well as myself for a number of years. And great to have him back out there with us. But it's primarily my coaching staff. So for on the defensive side of the ball, we have John Robinson and Cliff Axelholm as co-coordinators. Anthony Grimes,
a famous standout at Salem High School in his playing days. He's coaching defensive backs. And then on offense, we have Coach Christie, who's doing wide receivers, and Mark Sampson, who is doing offensive line. So we pretty much have our whole staff there, and makes it a lot easier to install a lot of the concepts that we're trying to do, obviously having guys that work with me for over 10 years.
I guess, let's wrap it up with one question back to Salem football, if we could. Tell me about your non-league schedule, because that's a key component nowadays for teams as to who they have in the non-league. And so tell us more about what you're planning this fall for Salem football, for the schedule and the non-league schedule.
Yeah, no, happy to. I think, you know, for us, the last few years, our non-league schedule was designed to compete in Division VI. And unfortunately, and we're also in the process of building our program. And unfortunately, last couple of years, we got moved to Division IV. So that schedule didn't kind of put us in the best position when it came to postseason play. So that was a big factor going into this season. You know, we've really set a good foundation at Salem, and we really want to be competitive. So we've kind of flipped our schedule a little bit when it comes to strength of opponents, you know, for those first few games. You know, we're going to come right out of the gate with Arlington. And I do think that's going to, again, be a competitive matchup for week one. And then we play Danvers week two. So very, very different, you know, from previous years. But I know that our guys, especially our upperclassmen, are really excited about the shift in schedule. You know, they want to go out and really prove, you know, they got the stuff to compete. So it's definitely motivating them right now in the weight room. You know, we got a good attendance there in our summer program, and hopefully that translates right over into the fall.
Sounds good. Well, Matt, anything else you want to share with us, either about Salem football or about the Aganis All-Star game that is coming up on Wednesday? And, of course, you're coaching the North team. Anything on that I didn't ask you about that you think is important?
Just one thing to highlight, because obviously I didn't get a chance to go through everybody. I will say that, you know, I didn't highlight some of the young men from Triton, but one young man I'd like to highlight is Max. Max is a coming senior year, obviously, at Triton, playing quarterback there. And he actually has been kind of a linchpin in our ability to kind of get things deployed. So really, really it's been a pleasure working with Max, and, you know, I'm obviously looking forward to watching him get out there and actually, you know, put all the pieces that he's helped build this last week into play, and hopefully, like I said earlier, put on a little bit of a show.
Sounds good. Well, Coach, thank you so much for your time. We'll be talking again soon, I guess, as the high school season approaches. But best of luck to you guys and, of course, the players from the North in Wednesday's All-Star game. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Mac Bouchard, Salem High football coach, excuse me, gave him another job there. Salem High football coach, and also, of course, the coach of the North squad for the Aganis All-Star football game to be played on Wednesday.